Hello and welcome to another episode of Bankers Africa. I am, of course, Miss Purple, and today I'm very excited to be speaking with someone that I got to meet by chance, and I finally coerced him to actually come onto the podcast, and his name is Atsu Davo. Before he introduces himself, I'm just going to give you a quick short intro. Now, Atsu Davo is the founder and CEO of BitSeeker, which is a payments app for Africa that is commonly referred to as the cash app for Africa, known as the Pivot King on Twitter. Atsu is also currently building Ear One, which seeks to help creators make money. Hi, Atsu. How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. Very happy to be here. It's one of my first podcasts in a while, so very happy to talk. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you for coming on. I really hope it's worth your time after so long. Now, before we get into the crux of the conversation, I need to know, what's with the name on Twitter, the Pivot King? Is there a reason behind that?
The name Pivot King, first of all, I change my name quite often. So within a few weeks, you might see me change it again. But I think that name was more of like a self-motivating quote, kind of, because my company, BitSeeker, we're in the middle of, like, I think our biggest pivot yet, and it's kind of stressful when you have to change the direction of your company because of circumstantial reasons. And so one way I motivate myself through that journey is to remind myself of previous successful pivots that we've done in the past, right? Like how we used to just be a USSD platform and then we became a very popular mobile app. How we used to just be fintech and then we added fintech and social together. How, you know, just basically how we just wanted to do remittance and then we added virtual cards and, you know, bill payments and crypto and like a lot of things. I've seen like, let's say, three or four instances where we made changes that could be characterized as pivots, and they worked out so well. Like, you know, putting your head down in uncertainty and just toiling, slaving away the days till you bring out that product or that feature and then it becoming a success. We've done that about three or four times. So I think now that we are in, I think, our most important pivot yet, you know, it always pays to remind yourself just how many times you've done this. And I just, a way to give confidence to yourself, motivation to yourself. So that's why I remember that, oh, okay, I know this is a stressful time, but like, man, I've done this successfully three or four times. I'm the fucking pivot king. Like, that's... That's who I am. Yeah.
I salute that so much. I truly, truly appreciate it because it feels so, so authentic. You know, it's not just, oh, he just came up with a name. It's also, you know, it's a personal process thing. I think it would look great on a t-shirt too. I'm just saying, you know, just it's a really cool thing to say to oneself. But okay, so I know that, you know, cliche questions are not your absolute favorite, but I have to ask, who exactly is Atsu Davo? You know, there's not much we can find about you online. I know that you studied both in Ghana and in the US, but outside of that, is there anything about yourself outside of, you know, being a forward thinker and a persistent builder? Is there anything else about yourself that you'd like to share with the listener?
So I'm actually a very simple kind of person. I come from a very normal middle-class background in Ghana. I grew up in Ghana all my life, from nursery to literally high school. After high school, I got the opportunity to study in America on a scholarship. So I went to college in a small but very good liberal arts college in Minnesota in the U.S. called Carleton College. I had a chance to go there. One of the best schools, one of the best schools in America. So, like, just being a kid from Ghana, getting the opportunity, I think it was definitely a remarkable time in my life. A great opportunity that I don't think most kids in Africa would get. So, me having that chance to do that, I think, you know, that was really cool. But then one thing about me is that I'm always looking out the window. So everywhere I am, I'm always like looking out the window. I know there's that phrase that, you know, the grass is not always greener, but like I always look out the window to see if the grass is actually there. So I think when I went to college, I became quite distracted. So honestly, I didn't even go to college to be a tech bro. I wanted to be in media. I wanted to be like a director. Yes. But so this is going to sound a little problematic, but I had a lot of international student friends, because international students, we were friends with each other, because a lot of us could not relate with the white kids. Not white, I mean American kids. We couldn't relate too strongly with American kids on a general level. So a lot of the international kids were just friends with each other. So I had a lot of the Chinese kids were like the most represented in our international year group. So most of my, a lot of my friends were Chinese kids. And, you know, they are very technologically savvy. They are extremely brilliant at computers, at math, at all that. I know maybe it's a stereotype, but like it was true. Like that was my experience. So I guess me being around them and they working on all these tech things, I got a little bit of peer pressure from that. So as they say, peer pressure can be positive or negative. I think I got the positive peer pressure, right? Like my friends who come back from the summer and they'll be like, oh, they worked at Facebook or they worked at, you know, Google. So like it was just so kind of like inspiring. And then the cool things they were building. So I started just learning coding on my own when I was in school. Ended up building, getting good at it quite quickly. Built a few projects with friends whilst we were in school and all that. So that's how my journey started. So very quickly, I lost interest in actual schoolwork and just wanted to be building things on my own in my free time. And it got so bad that like I just wanted to just drop out and come back to Africa to help build some things down here. So I think it's not just about my willpower or anything like that. I think it has a lot to do as well with the timing, right? Because it was around the time that tech was becoming quite like popular around the world, everywhere, not just in the States or wherever, or in Europe or Asia, but in Africa as well. Like, you know, people could afford Android phones in Africa. So all these smartphones and apps, they were just booming in a way that they did not boom literally 5 years ago or 10 years ago. So it was just a whole new world and there was just big, big opportunities. So I decided to come down. And me coming down to, again, the timing was perfect because it coincided with, you know, Bitcoin becoming mainstream as well. So me learning how to code, me dropping out of school. So I didn't finish school, actually. Me dropping out of school, Bitcoin becoming popular, it all sort of like coincided in a perfect timing. And then, yeah, so I think that's how idea for Bitsika came about, was that I was like, hey, I know how to code. This Bitcoin thing sounds so exciting. That was like, so I came back in 2016, but around the end of 2017, so over a year had passed, and people couldn't stop talking about Bitcoin. I think that's when Bitcoin achieved its like first like 20K, 19K valuation price mark. And people couldn't stop talking about it. Literally, your mom and dad and your uncles and aunties were all like texting you about Bitcoin. I don't even remember back then. So yeah, that season is like, nah, if this is going to be the future or this is going to be the exciting thing, whatever. Okay, I'm a newly minted dev. Let me try and build something related to, you know, to Bitcoin. Let me just try to build something and see. So that's when the first idea of Bitsika came about. That, oh, okay, I want to build something that the local people would appreciate and that investors might find attractive to also give me money as well. So I built a USSD app called Bitica where you can dial a short code. We create a phone number, attach it to your, we create a Bitcoin address, attach it to your phone number. And now you can send crypto to people's phone numbers. So let's say if I want to send you Bitcoin, I don't need to know your long address. All I need is your phone number, which I already have inputted, and I can send you Bitcoin. You could also buy Bitcoin with mobile money on the same USSD. So essentially, the kind of product it was that you could have the shittiest phone. As long as it has a phone connection, you can dial our USSD short code. We give you a free Bitcoin address. You can buy Bitcoin mobile money. So basically being able to, it was one of the first ways people could use Bitcoin without like a direct internet connection. So it was a very nerdy, but very interesting kind of project. And that's how my first investor, Yele, currently of Nescoin, that's how he heard about me, messaged me that he was the director of Binance at the time, asked me to apply to Binance, which I did. And he guided us like with advice and stuff. And then, you know, yeah. So that's how, I guess, Bitica was born.
No, it's okay. Thank you for sharing the story. I think also it's always fascinating when you notice just how, you know, well connected the space tends to be, because, you know, we have had Yele on the podcast before, and we talked about his journey as well from Binance and then to Nescoin. And of course, now they're working on Onboard. So it's very interesting to see that everybody tends to kind of, you know, circulate around each other, which shows just how important the community is. You know, for a lot of people, you can't just do this in an isolated manner. You need to be aware to connect with, you know, the relevant people who are also being active within the space. Now, you and I have, of course, been speaking off air, and you've mentioned quite briefly that there is a possibility for BitSeeker to gear itself towards being a more peer-to-peer platform. What can you share on that?
So I've actually not even done a big public declaration, but I'm happy to, you know, talk to you about it as openly as possible. It's not a secret, like, development or whatever, but I've not really made a formal announcement to the public yet. So basically, we are in the very middle of our biggest pivot yet as a company. Like I said, I'm the pivot king. I think I've gotten some criticism from people that are like, in just a few years, BitSeeker has been there. You guys have pivoted like 3 or 4 times. And I'm like, that's why we're still alive. Excuse me. So we're doing it again, like I said. So up to now, from like when BitSeeker became an app, right? That's the BitSeeker people know. So the BitSeeker people know is not even the USSD. It's like the mobile app. And there's an interesting story about the mobile app as well. I think how that also came up, transition from pivoting from the USSD to the mobile app, is also another interesting story on its own. You can ask me. But we are transitioning now from the mobile app, like the normal fintech app where you put in money and then you exchange for another currency or for a virtual card or for, you know, cross-border. We are pivoting from that to a peer-to-peer transaction platform. And the main difference here is that with the fintech, when you deposit money in order to withdraw another currency, you are essentially trading with a platform whose app you're using. So let's say you put in CDs, Ghana CDs, you're withdrawing Nigerian Naira, you are more or less trading with BitSeeker for the Naira at their rates, at everything, right? You are trading with BitSeeker. But with the peer-to-peer, you're not really trading with the platform. You're trading with other users on the platform, right? So the platform just pays matchmaker. I think of it like Tinder, a dating app, where it's like we connect you to the people you're looking for, and then you guys take it on from there. So that's what we are becoming. And structurally speaking, that's what we are becoming. I think for us as a company, it comes with a lot of advantages that, to me, okay, this is a no-brainer. This is like, you know, like it's a no-brainer. If I'm to mention a few just off the top of my head, number one, building a peer-to-peer platform means we don't get to deal with liquidity problems anymore, because On a normal fintech app, you always have to make sure there's enough Naira, there's enough CDs, there's enough Bitcoin, there's enough. It's always the problem. And if a user who is so big, who has so big of a request for trading, wants to transact on an app, you may not have enough money for them and it becomes a whole thing. But with a peer-to-peer platform, since users are transacting with each other, if I want to buy $100 worth of Naira, I just have to make sure there's an opposite person who has enough Naira to sell to me at the rate I want. So it makes liquidity no more the company's problem, but it makes it infinitely flexible. The more people come looking for things to trade, the more people who are going to be there to trade with them, because it's a supply and demand market. So even if people come to the tune of wanting to trade $10 billion a day, it will attract people who have $10 billion a day to sell to them. So that makes it very perfect. As a company, again, it prevents us from dealing with FX risk, because we are not trading to you anymore. So whether the market crashes, the market goes up, goes down, we don't care. We just want whatever small fee you are going to pay us, that's what we're going to get. So think about, like, we don't have to deal with FX risks anymore. We don't have to deal with liquidity risk anymore. But by far the most important thing that is informing our transition is trying to position ourselves in a more regulatory resistant way. Because right now, as a fintech product, we're in about 11 or 12 countries. We've just had so much trouble with regulators, with compliance, with things like that. We've just had so much problems with institutions like that, like trying to take this out of your app. You can't come into our country. You can't do this. You can't do that. You can't. Like, I just wanted to build apps, build features for people to use. And in the very early years, 2019, 2020, we got to do that because COVID happened and the regulators, they had bigger problems to work on. So 2020, in my opinion, was literally the best year for fintech because of just the freedoms that we had, because our regulators were distracted. But immediately people realized the scope of COVID and were like, okay, COVID is a manageable thing. It's not the end of the world. They brought their attention back to us, and it's been more or less hell off ever since, not just for Bitsika, but for a lot of similar fintechs and stuff, right? So I think pivoting to peer-to-peer also removes us from that regulatory conversation, because we are no longer going to use any API like Flutterwave or like, you know, any of those kind of things, because users are just transacting between each other. So we don't need any fintech API to, because we are not the ones they are transacting with. So I think that for me, that's the most important, that freedom of, I want to go back to building fintech platforms that people can just use, they can enjoy, they can rave about. And I don't have to be scared about every feature I build that, can we really release this feature? They're going to ban us. Can we do this? They're going to ban. I'm tired of doing that. I just want to go back to how things used to be. You just build something, you release it, and then people just love it, and then they use it. So I think peer-to-peer would help us achieve that. And regardless to peer-to-peer, even all things being said, it's like a huge market right now. Binance is literally doing billions in multiple countries annually, monthly. So I don't know. It's also a very lucrative sector to go into. Crypto crypto and AI are the two biggest topics of our 2020s decade. I don't know if you would agree with me. From my vantage point, I think it's crypto and AI is going to define this decade, unless people discover something new. But crypto and AI are the new, are the defining topics of this decade. We're already in like the fourth year of the decade already. So I don't know. I want to see if Bitsika can play our role in the coming decade, so that when all is said and done, we would have also contributed to the history of crypto development on this continent.
I love the way you put that. And I agree with you, you know, in that crypto and AI, they are very big hot topics. And mostly because a lot of it is still so misunderstood and a lot of people are still trying to figure out how to learn about it. And obviously by the point where, you know, you reach a a much wider mass adoption, you're going to then start having people creating more innovations, maybe creating more contenders to BitSeeker, and maybe they want to compete for your market share, anything of the sort. But, you know, from an episode or from a podcast that you did literally 3 years ago, which was 2020, you said in 2020 that it was going to be the best year for crypto. And you just said again that it was. So I'm curious to know what markers you were seeing that made you aware that 2020 was going to be such a good year, and perhaps how you would then use those markers to look at this year. How are you seeing this year panning out, you know, for crypto in particular?
So I think 2020 was sort of like the combination of a lot of variables, as people say sometimes, the stars aligned, like a lot of variables just being, you know, in place at the right time. And it was not like luck or arbitrary, right? It was the end product of so much work that had been done over the course of the mid-2010s downwards, right? So 2020. So what I mean by that is like development of, you know, proliferation of smartphones in developing communities, development of provision of development tools for crypto, right? Like simple APIs that people could use, wallets, development of fintech, fiat APIs by local telcos, mobile money, banking systems, things like that as well. There's the growth of crypto and Bitcoin in its own ecosystem as well. People becoming more aware of it. People becoming more aware of its benefit. Tools being available for people, hardware wallets being built, software, mobile wallets being built, education being available on Reddit, YouTube, all over the internet, APIs being available. And then COVID-19 taking the regulator's mind away. Those things all matured at the very same time. If crypto was here, but people didn't have smartphones, it would go nowhere. If crypto was here, but fintech APIs did not exist, it would go nowhere. If crypto was here, but there was no COVID-19 and regulators were super focused on us, it would go nowhere. So I think 2020 was just... So like everything coming together in perfect condition. I think it's a testament to, and if you're asking, like, that's a good question you're asking about, what does it say about how we can replicate it in the future? I think the way we can replicate in the future is to, okay, are you building the tools today that would create the 2020 of the next 3 years, of the next 2 years, of the next year? Like, what tools are you building today that, and what tool is the next guy building? What tool is the third guy building that will all mature at the same time to create a perfect condition like that? So the lesson there for me is very simple. We just need to keep building whatever I'm doing. And I'm playing my part by building our peer-to-peer platform. So, So the stagnation is how companies die. Stagnation is how products die. So I think as a founder, never let anyone shame you for pivoting, because if someone wants to shame you for pivoting, let them go read about Kodak. Let them go read about AOL. Let them go read about MTV. Let them go read about pets.com. Let them go read about Yahoo, right? Like, if someone wants to guilt trip you for, like, why are you pivoting all the time? Like, why can't you just, like, stick to what you're already doing? Tell them to go read about yahoo.com, and then they would have a good idea. So that's what I'll say. Like, momentum, movement, like hypothesizing and moving. I think that's how we achieve a breakthrough year like 2020 in the future.
100%. I say pivots save lives. And if you don't evolve, you get left behind. So... so as per an article by Quartz, Africa, and this was written in 2022. So as of 2022, Africa now accounts for 70% of the world's $1 trillion mobile money value. The value of Africa's mobile money transactions edged up 39% to $701.4 billion in 2021 from $495 billion in 2020. That's a 39% shift in just a single year. And $800 million of the $495 billion in 2020 all came from Nigeria in terms of transaction volume. So would being a peer-to-peer platform in any way perhaps pose as compete with the existing mobile money apps? Do you think you could potentially put up a challenge for them, or are you looking to build something so completely different that they maybe can feel that you are not even in the same caliber as them?
So let me start by saying that crypto currently is still considered very niche. Like, oh, I have a sister who she's so into crypto, or I have there's this guy in my school, he's so crypto savvy. Like, we still hear comments like that, right? But I like to cast, maybe we were too young to have vivid examples like 20 years ago, but if you quite remember when you were growing up, that same phrasing was used for the internet, that, oh wow, my big bro, he's such an internet nerd. Like, he knows about the internet a lot. Wow, my uncle, he's so internet savvy. He's so like, and today everyone is on WhatsApp. Everyone is on Instagram. So there's nothing like an internet savvy person anymore. That word, there's nothing like an internet savvy person. You get what I mean? Internet culture was so niche back then, but now your mom and dad, they're on WhatsApp. So like, who, there's nobody called an internet savvy person. So first of all, I'll say that if people are still being called like, oh, he's so crypto savvy, she's so crypto savvy, it should just give you an idea of like, oh, okay, this is the same trajectory we're on, where it's like something that's so niche is eventually going to become so useful and so mainstream that like, it's going to be part of everyone's life without even thinking. Because people who use WhatsApp today, they are not using WhatsApp because they are on the internet or they want to be part of the global village. No, they're using internet because they use WhatsApp to talk to their children. That's it. Like, you understand? The benefits have become so so detached from the idea of the technology itself that I'm not an internet user. I don't care about the fucking internet. I just want to talk to my kid who's in Zambia. And WhatsApp is the fastest way to do that. I don't care about your fucking internet. You get what I mean? So crypto now is very niche, very okay, so crypto savvy. But I can see a world where crypto infiltrates every form of everyday payment. And you wouldn't have to be sort of like crypto savvy to use crypto anymore. So if crypto is a 1 billion or 10 billion, let's say it's a $10 billion annual industry in Africa, I think it could grow even 100 times more. It could grow even 200 times more, right? And crypto growing 200 times than it is now is definitely gonna have impact on other industries, right? And mobile money is a good example, because what I think is the biggest opportunity in the next 10 years, crypto-wise, is people having a way to move from fiat to crypto and from crypto to fiat. That is going to be the biggest opportunity. Because in an ideal world where, let's say, crypto takes over mobile money, all the billions of dollars that are mobile money, they have to be moved into crypto. And how are people going to do that? So I would say, yes, there is going to be that transition. Yes, it might even end up becoming way bigger than mobile money, because with crypto, there are no borders. Mobile money is always restricted to a geographical location. But with crypto, there's literally no border between Africans and globally as well. So just think about it that way. Yes, crypto is going to become mainstream. Yes, it's going to be magnitudes bigger than Momo. And yes, there'll be a very big opportunity for helping people move from crypto to fiat and fiat to crypto. So that's what I think.
Now, this question, it comes from perhaps me understanding why some people may be concerned when they see you pivoting. And it's perhaps because maybe they don't fully understand what the end goal is. So is there an end goal for BitSecure? Do you have a particular target that you're gearing yourself towards? You make Bitcoin and crypto more accessible to people, and then what? You know, is there something in particular that you're hoping for that, you know, encourages you to keep pivoting until you can reach that point, no matter what it takes?
Yeah, so there are a few things. So number one, I would say that people are already moving to crypto annually, every year, every month, new Africans, whether it's young people having that as sort of like part of their whole value system growing up, or older people rediscovering something new, right? Crypto is introducing and onboarding more and more people. But people, especially Africans, I don't think we still have very user-friendly ways to onboard people into crypto. So actually, like what my investor Yile, his products on board at Nesgrin, I think that's actually kind of like in the same direction. Like when he showed me what was building, I was like, oh shit, like, wow. If Yile is doing almost the same thing I'm doing, then that means I'm on the right track. But people are going to get onboarded. Millions and millions of people are going to get onboarded into crypto. So we need a user-friendly way to bring them in. We need a secure way to bring them in. We need a way to bring them in that caters to the very specific reasons why they're coming in. We need, because we don't want people coming to crypto and getting driven away because they find it so daunting. Like if you download the Binance app right now, you need your friend to help you go through it as a new user. You wouldn't have an idea what you're doing. Old users may know their way around. But if you're a brand new person, you've heard about crypto, whatever, you open the app, you wouldn't know what to do. And I'm even speaking from experience. I usually use Binance on my laptop. So as part of market research for what I was building, I downloaded the mobile version. And even I had a hard time knowing where this button was or that button. It was just kind of confusing to me. So imagine people with no bearing at all, right? And it's important that we enable people to smoothly and swiftly move into crypto, especially as Africans, because I think a lot of African countries are notorious for not having the best reputation when it comes to protecting the assets of their citizens, right? You can talk about a lot of countries where corrupt politicians or government people who see you as dissidents could lock your accounts or could block you, or for whatever whimsical reason. So developing worlds, countries, societies with dictatorships, which Africa has a lot of dictatorships, has a lot of on paper democracies that are technically dictatorships as well. Like just a lot of those kind of like societies where citizens need protection when it comes to their assets. So crypto is actually a very delicate, very instrumental product for Africa. Think about how like crypto has become so big in Africa because of it fostering cross-border transfers, right? Before crypto, sending money to your next African country was like the biggest headache in the world. Like you didn't even know how to do that. But now with crypto, so crypto is just so important that we need to give people the best experience ever when coming into that field. But apart from that as well, another controversial thing I want to say, I think I said at the Web3 conference, is that I'm not happy that the biggest crypto players in Africa are Chinese people or are foreigners. I hope I'm not being xenophobic, because I'm not. But I think that crypto was one of the last industries where, Africans had the opportunity to be major stakeholders in their own industry. Because every new technological breakthrough that comes along, like Africa just has just 1% of it. Think about vehicles. Like, I don't know any African country that makes cars. I don't know if South Africa makes cars. I don't know if Egypt or those countries make cars. But we probably account for 1% or less of car manufacturing. We probably account for 0% of airplane manufacturing, a whole continent of 1 billion people. You get what I mean? We probably account for like internet connection, like how many internet companies are like African grown. We probably account for just 1%. So every new technological breakthrough that comes, it starts from the Western world and it comes to Africa, and even comes to Africa in the form of Western countries as well, right? Africa has, even our own natural resources like gold and diamond and stuff like that, most of the companies that are responsible for mining or extracting those resources are foreign companies as well. So for me, it's very ideological. Like crypto was supposed to be one of the last industries where it's like, oh, all you need to be involved in crypto was your laptop, your phone, and an internet connection, and then you can start building on top of it. So crypto is supposed to be that that kind of industry or whatever the case may be, right? But if you look at just how our local governments, our regulators, our central banks have just cracked down on local companies, I think that after a few years of that happening, you can see that they've literally given our last hope of an industry, giving it on a silver platter to foreigners, Chinese, Americans, and that. So for me, building Bitsika into a peer-to-peer platform, for me, is very, very ideological.
I just wanted to, you know, add on the example you were making about manufacturing. I know South Africa manufactures their cars quite a lot. In fact, I believe a majority of the cars on South African roads have to be put together in South Africa. I mean, it may be a foreign brand, but the manufacturing itself and, you know, compiling the car and actually building it and putting it together is usually done in Africa. But I'm curious to know then, do you feel that it's too late for us to, as the continent, make our own strides within the crypto space? Have we been left too far behind? Do you also think that maybe the reason we have so many, you know, foreigners taking control of the reins to move forward this particular industry, but also other industries, is it because we have an ingrained distrust amongst ourselves that we don't believe we're capable of doing these things? Or we just have old people that don't know any better and they're just looking for a quick way out?
I don't think it's too late. I don't think it's too late because, like I said, crypto is not mainstream yet. As long as you keep hearing words about people being crypto savvy, it means it's just not mainstream yet. So if there is any opportunity, so if you see products like Onboard coming out, you see products like Bitsika P2P coming out, and trust me, there are probably other smaller projects that people don't even know about that are also going to come out. Bigger African companies might also have their own crypto play as well. So for me, I think that it's really not late, but if we really want to address the problem, it can't just be about, oh, I'm going to come to the market and make my small profit and go. It has to be an ideological thing of like, oh, this is what's happening now. And if as a company we're coming on board, this needs to be our North Star. That I like Bitsika. So I think you asked me about metrics or how we're going to measure our success, right? I think you asked that question. I think one important thing is that I'd like Bitsika to be the biggest crypto company in Ghana, at least. That would be a good starting point for me. Hopefully in the whole Africa, but I think if you can have your big goal, but you can also have your realistic goal. In Ghana, I want Bitsika to be the biggest app. Like if a kid in university wants, like he tells his friends, oh, I want to buy $10 worth of Bitcoin, I want his friends to tell him Bitsika. I want Bitsika to be the biggest crypto app in Ghana. And then if we could get Nigeria, that'll be a big win. If we can get Kenya, if we can get Cameroon, if we can get Senegal, like those will also be big achievements as well. So that's how I'm looking at it. So it has to be ideological. You have to understand that, this is what's happening and I'm not happy about it. So if I'm going to play this game, this is what I want to achieve. So it needs to be intentional. It needs to be ideological.
There was something that you briefly touched on. I know that, of course, for BitSecure, it was also probably very intentional because you went the USSD route when you first started. Now, for maybe those who may not be aware, mobile devices generated most of the web traffic in Africa as per 2022, with over 70% of, you know, all internet access across Africa being mobile. Laptops and desktops, desktop computers, they only account for about 25%. And I'm not really sure where the other percent comes from, the other 5%, but essentially it's 70% of us are on mobile phone to access the internet. And then the other 25% is, you know, on laptops or computers. But we also know that the DeFi space and, you know, everything around it, it tends to be more geared towards people who use PCs and computers. Do you think this is the reason why USSD has been so successful? And perhaps do you think this is maybe why it's taking a bit longer for people to adopt crypto in Africa? Because a lot of us are just using our phones, you know, so there's certain platforms that I know I can't access unless I'm at home and I'm sitting down in front of a computer, because on my phone it just doesn't work, you know. You can't configure it the right way, like how you said you had a hard time using Binance on mobile because you were used to it on PC. My problem is the other way around. I can't use Binance on my PC. I can't, it confuses me. But on mobile, it's so much easier for me because it's like, okay, I go over there, because I'm so used to being on my phone more than being on my computer. So could this be something that's perhaps somewhat of a hindrance towards people maybe adopting more, you know, experimenting more with certain things? Because how is a person going to experiment with, say, ZK era on your phone? You can't. You would have to literally have a computer. Could this be something that's setting us back in some way?
Man, that's a very interesting perspective. I actually never considered that. That's actually kind of interesting. But I'll say that even if that's kind of true, though. That's kind of true. Like, crypto products being native to certain devices and not other devices. But I feel like in as much as we're building accessibility of crypto, like in various countries, I think the UX, user experience of crypto in general, globally, is also something that different teams are also working on. So that's, we are on a different UX journey for crypto as we speak. But one thing I truly believe in is the fact that there is no uniform sort of user experience that we should impose on all crypto people, right? There are people who want to use crypto for remittance. There are people who want to use crypto for custody. There are people who want to use crypto for sovereignty. There are people who want to use crypto for signatures. They would have different user experience. Crypto is usually packaged as this one-for-all composite solution. But I feel like we need to really understand that people have different uses for crypto, and we'll build the user experience differently for everyone. Yeah, that's one thing I believe in as well.
So you mentioned before that you've had to pivot BitSecure multiple times, and you're in the process of another pivot right now. Do you ever feel that you could potentially regret this particular line of work that you chose? Because pivoting is not easy, you know, it's not easy by any means necessary. And not to, you know, belittle the work of the media space, because I'm in media and I know that's also not easy. But do you ever feel like maybe you could have had an easier time sticking around in media versus coming over into the bankless crypto side of things?
Well, okay, what I'll say is that coming into tech, and my whole tech journey is crypto, basically. So coming to tech/crypto, I'd say that it's been the most rewarding thing ever in my life, most rewarding experience in my life, because me coming to this industry, I've got to work on so many interesting things at a large scale at a very young age when I started. I got to meet people I never thought I would meet, the most coolest tech bros, investors, got the most amazing people to support my dreams. So yeah, I wouldn't change it for nothing. And actually, I'm not the kind of person that wants to work on let me use the word, like, simple things. No, I want to work on things that are, you know, substantial, things that have an effect on the world, things that, and yeah, it wouldn't, if you're going to build something remarkable, it wouldn't be easy at all. So we do it actually because it's hard. And that's where the most rewarding work comes from. It comes from doing things that are hard. So yeah, I wouldn't change it for nothing. Like I love doing the hard things. As long as I have people who support me, which I have a lot, I'll just keep on going. The long and short about that whole thing is that it's the kind of journey where once you reach, so we making this pivot, every big pivot we've made has more or less worked out fantastically. So in case this one also works out, it will potentially work at a scale that we've never seen before. And it will make all the sleepless nights worth it. It will make all the hard work worth it. So yeah, I do it because it's hard. Yeah.
That's refreshing to hear. I do it because it's hard. I don't know that I could say I do something because it's hard. I would struggle to do that. I have to have, you know, a bit more passion and things. But yeah, I know that you are looking for a trustworthy DevOps. How can folks exactly reach out to you, or perhaps to some of your team members, if they have recommendations of people that they know? Keyword being trustworthy. Okay. That's the key word here.
I'm on Twitter. Just message me. So me, everything I do is very casual, very informal. So I'm not going to do any like rigorous, whatever. Just, email me, DM me on Twitter. I'll look at your profile, your GitHub or your LinkedIn, and then I'll pass you over to my technical team, and then they will put you through like an actual review process.
Okay, so we're going to close it off with a final question that I like to ask every single guest that we have on the podcast. And it's essentially, in three words, can you describe how you feel about the space based off of, you know, what you've seen, what you're hoping to see, and what you're currently seeing happening? Three words on how you describe the Web3, the crypto space, the entire DeFi, everything about, you know, the industry that you're working in. How would you describe it in three words?
I'd say number one, we are behind. We are behind because we obviously are. We've not seen many DeFi projects come out of Africa. We've not seen many long-lasting CeFi projects come out of Africa. They always get shut down. So whether it's our fault or not, we are behind. Number two, I think we're also complacent, rather. I think in a lot of situations, when we get downtrodden, we don't react fast enough. And we are too eager to comply with the regulators. We're too eager to fall in line. We're too eager to go into bed with them. I see that as a weakness as well. And third, I'll say third, we're still hopeful. Even with those two things not in our favor, I'd say we're still very hopeful. Like, look at me trying to still pivot. Look at Yele coming back after what they've been through as a company. I think we're still very, very hopeful, and it shows in the kind of steps we're taking.
Those are very, you know, refreshing words. They remind you that there's still a lot of work that we still need to do, because I know a lot of people, it's very exciting words, you know, to say it's promising, it's everything else, which they're all great and well, but sometimes you need a reality check to remind you that maybe you need to be a bit more, you know, bullish with your intentions, maybe be a bit more pushy, a bit more intentional and deliberate in everything that it is that you do. But thank you again so much for agreeing to be on the podcast. And to you, the listener, remember that nothing here is financial advice, because we're not financial advisors in that way. Always do your own research, and don't forget to share or leave us a review or a comment on what you think of the show and how else we can continue to improve. Now, remember, there is an entire world out there that is yet to be discovered. And this time, Africa is at the core of the table.